Today is October 22, 2019, and my name is Deborah Schwartz. I'm with the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Public Library. I'm very pleased to be here today on a beautiful fall day with Ken Bovaro. Correct?
Bovaro, yes.
Bovaro. And you're going to tell me about that name.
Good.
Ken, you're owner of Marin County Arborists. You're a native of Marin. You hold certificates from the International Society of Arboriculture, as well as the National Arborist Association, and you're a member of the California Arborists. What else?
Let's see. A vast background in arboriculture in many aspects, including expert witness testimony in high-profile cases, training the SPCA how to do animal rescues. Sometimes cats, and I remember one time they had a monkey that they had to recover from a tree. So that was an interesting situation to walk them through. I believe they were successful.
One never thinks of an arborist expanding in that direction,
yeah.
But makes sense.
Yeah.
And you really are in our relations that I've known you on and off over the years in the capacity of your work. You really are a Marin County boy.
I am. Truly. Been here, born 61 in San Francisco. Moved to Marin in 1963 as a young hippie kid with a brother and unfortunately a recently deceased sister.
And their names?
Catherine was my sister who passed away at 9 with cystic fibrosis. Mm-hmm. And then my brother, Bobby, who was Bobby Bovaro, who was just a bit of a wild child from the day he was born and still is to this day. So
wilder than you?
Wilder than me, believe it or not.
That says a lot.
Well, 40 years of career convict and tattoos covering his neck and his whole body, and 40 years of heroin addiction as well. So it's unfortunate, but there's not much I can do. I've spent a lifetime trying to help him and save him, and I realize that it's something he has to do for himself.
Yeah. So you've seen a lot of different faces of the county.
I have.
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for coming to the Mill Valley Public Library. You're an outdoor guy.
Yes.
It's a busy season for you, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come share your story with the Mill Valley Historical Society and the library.
You're very welcome. I enjoy sharing my story, so it's great to be here.
Is there anything that we shouldn't talk about?
Nothing whatsoever.
You're an open book.
I am.
Good. All right. Let's start with a little bit about you growing up here in Marin County. Can you remember what it was like? And no, you know what? Hold that thought.
Okay.
Let's start with your family.
Okay.
Let's start with how your family came to San Francisco. Tell me a little bit. You've got an Italian name.
I do. Okay, so my grandfather, Philip Bovaro, had come over on a boat in the early 1900s with a group of his friends and landed in New York. So then he went and lived in Utah, where he met my grandmother, Verna, that he married. And so Verna and Philip ended up having my father, Robert Bovaro, my uncle, Jim Bovaro, and then which of our the families had their own children, so my cousins as well. So then my grandfather was a very astute musician. So he played the clarinet, the saxophone, and the piano, and wrote music. So he traveled the Bay Area doing the whole jazz scene in the 40s and 50s. So, and during Prohibition, he was making his own alcohol
He
was a bootlegger.
So
he was living down in the avenues by SI. I wish I could remember.
There were places, like in his basement.
In his basement. His friends would come over and drink with him. Yeah, it was crazy. And he'd write music and drink, and he was just such a character. Yeah.
I've never heard of bootleggers in the avenues, but why not?
Yeah. Right? He'd do it for himself. He wouldn't do it to sell it. He'd make his alcohol for him and his friends to share.
I guess you could say he was kind of practical. If you can't buy it, make it.
Yeah.
I bet you he wasn't the only one.
Oh, I'm sure he wasn't.
Yeah.
No, I would imagine he and his friends were all doing this, right?
So how about your mother's family?
So my mother's family, Bertram Hughes, my mother's father, very interesting story. So he was the first one to import Datsun and Toyota to the United States. So he was a body man, was there when they created Bondo. He was part of the initial tests and the process of creating Bondo, and took his money that he had made and invested in shipping cars from Japan to the piers where Pac Bell Park is, where the Giants play. And so this was his business. So he'd set up these shipping containers stuffed with vehicles that his employees would drive up and out and into this huge warehouse. And then he had a big dispute with the trucking company that he was working with. So he ended up buying his own trucking business and expanded it. So he was a very dynamic man. He was drank a lot, partied a lot. You'd usually find him out and about at the local bars. He was the Golden Gloves boxing champion in San Francisco for 3 years, when they used to fight with their hands stacked like this, as opposed to the current day style. And he was a character.
Well, I can imagine what I can see, but those listening to us right now, is how brawny you are.
Yeah.
I mean, you look like the consummate lumberjack.
Yeah.
So he must have been like that.
Yeah, he was. And I have those. I boxed for several years myself, and I unfortunately would carry that out into, out drinking with my friends. And so I'd have to be careful of my actions, because I've always been the kind of wired that same way.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So he must have been in a few brawls in his time.
Yes, he was.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, he was. Good old San Francisco heart, So he was right in the middle of it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So, but you ended up coming to Mill Valley.
I did.
And how did that happen?
So that happened, my father met my mother. She was 17. She was in high school. She was a child, and she was pregnant. So he was 19 and she was 17. And by the time she was still 17, she was pregnant. So she was a child having children. Little did they know that they were both carriers of cystic fibrosis. So my sister Catherine was born with cystic fibrosis, and they didn't know till 2 or 3 years in. Mm-hmm. So my images of remembering her was when I was in a crib and she slept in a tented bed with a ventilation system coming in to keep her lungs as clear as they could with the medicines that they had available at the time. Mm-hmm. So when she passed at 9, I was 3 and my brother Bobby was 5. That had split my parents up so that my mother never got to really discover who she was, because she was a child having children and found herself gravitating more towards this hippie, the 60s and the hippie movement. And so they were kind of growing apart. So that was a separation point for them. And then so she started hanging out with Joe Farrakis, who was a photographer and owned some of those Flower Power stores down in the... what is that by Alioto's, that whole area there? It's called down at the wharf. Mm-hmm. So he had stores down there. He made leather goods. He was a real interesting character and lived up here on Lovell Avenue, up in this little shack where we had moved into with him in about 67. So no, it was before that, excuse me, because that was 63, about 64, 65. And so we lived there, my brother and I, my sister had passed. So we lived there in his house with him.
So your mom's only in her mid-20s by then.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Just a young, young woman. And Joe Farrakis was at least 20 years older than she was.
Did you like him?
I didn't, because he wasn't my father. And there was a side to him that was just different. It was something I wasn't used to.
Mm-hmm.
So not really, but there was a short-lived relationship. And then we moved to the Molino side. So up from the 2 a.m. club, as you go up Laverne, you make a right on Molino. So we lived on that steep part of the Molino, of Molino Avenue, and we stayed there. Wait, there's one piece I'm missing. So when she split up with Joe Farrakis, we moved to 44 Helens Lane, where we were for about 3 years. That's right. And it had a beautiful eucalyptus.
Over right where it meets Birch, like around there?
That's exactly it. Mm-hmm. It was like three houses before that.
Mm-hmm.
It was on that curve
mm-hmm.
right before you'd come to where Birch is.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my friend Tim Rack lived right across the street, and an ex-49er football player, Elmer Collette, lived in a big house right down the street.
Mm-hmm.
So that's exactly it. It was right there. Mm-hmm. And we had a big, beautiful eucalyptus tree in the yard there.
Mm-hmm. There were horses there. And I remember there were corrals up at the end of Birch.
Interesting.
Do you remember that?
I don't remember that.
Ah, in the 70s, there was.
So that was where Mr. Robinson, did you ever do the story about Mr. Robinson from the military, the old train? I went to school with the girl that did the interview and wrote a book about the old steam train or the old push train. Anyways, it's somewhere here in these archives. He was an interesting character. He's one of my tree clients. I'd love to hang out with him.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so then we lived on Helens Lane for about 3 years. And then my mother met a piano teacher, hippie guy, George Dunnaback. And so George Dunnaback was a Cal grad. My mother's age, and then she had a daughter, my sister Elizabeth, who's now a film producer and went to Brown University. My mother saw the direction that my brother and I were going. She's like, brakes, wait, no, we're going this way. So it was a quick change of direction because my brother and I were, we were getting in trouble.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what schools you went to, Old Mill?
So I went to Old Mill School, went kindergarten through second grade, started third grade at Homestead School, and then went third through fifth at Homestead, then went Mill Valley Middle School, and then Tam High, where I left before I was supposed to graduate, started climbing trees.
So when would you have graduated?
1980.
So who were your friends?
So my friends back in those days were some troubled kids. You know, I was hanging out with troubled kids. My brother and I were kind of left to fend for ourselves. So my mother, having a career working at UCSF in the city for a doctor, so she'd get on the bus early in the morning and usually wouldn't come back till 6 in the evening. So my brother and I would just fend for ourselves. So we Mill Valley was such a different place at that time. There was this element of kind of kids building hot rods and motorcycles, and people like my good friend Michael Bowen, who's an actor who spent years acting. Breaking Bad was one of the more recent pieces of work he did.
Mm-hmm.
Jackie Brown, a whole host of other things, some of the Tarantino films. And so then another amazing physical specimen of a human being, Dwight Popson, about 6'4" and 255 pounds, was the heavyweight boxing champ for the Marine Corps. And he punched out his drill sergeant because he got in an argument with him. And here he was released back into Mill Valley where his father lived, and just was the toughest, strongest
guy.
So
this would have been in the, what year, in the late 70s?
So here we go. So this is about 79-80 is when he gets out on his dishonorable discharge after doing a year in their brig. And here's this big old guy that we knew from when we were kids. He was the only guy in Little League that could hit the ball from the diamond, one diamond on one side, all the way over to the other side. He was just this, just his hand-eye coordination. He'd beat you in tennis, ping pong, pool, anything that had volleyball. I mean, he was an amazing athlete. His kid brother, the runt of the family, both of these characters worked on and off for me over the years doing tree work because they were physical specimens. And so I was like, I need to put them to work to help me do tree work. So they'd be carrying logs with me up hills and brush. So Ted Popson spent 3 years with the San Francisco 49ers in a Super Bowl ring in 1995 and 3 years with the Kansas City Chiefs, went there with Joe Montana. So kind of neat, interesting history of this Del Casa area over by the Boyle Park where these two brothers grew up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And at that time also there's in the by the 70s, some of the musicians were moving into Mill Valley.
Oh, yeah.
And the town had, I mean, when you think of a typical Mill Valley day in your childhood, what do you see? What you're going down the road, what's it like?
Okay, good.
Where are you going?
I like it. I like it. So usually we're going to march downtown and we're going to stomp through the creek, right? We're going to enter the creek at Old Mill Park and we're going to walk through downtown and pop out down by where Earl Johnson had his dentist practice down past the lumber company. And right, we're going to search for crawdads on the way. And so, and then there goes, you know, Sammy Hagar or Neil Sean. And so, and Elton John, I remember my girlfriend Tara, when I was in high school, was hitchhiking her way to school and was picked up by Elton John, her and her girlfriend in his big white Rolls Royce. I guess he was in town to record or, because they had that recording studio in Sausalito
right,
where all
the
these,
plant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and they had their plant house over in Tam Junction
yeah.
where the musicians would stay.
So that's interesting because I remember my first experience with Huey Lewis was they called themselves Clover. And I believe it was because they bought a Clover milk van. It said Clover on the side. And so when I was going to Homestead School, we used to walk across the street and sit down while they were jamming and playing music. And so it was interesting to be in and amongst all of that.
Mm-hmm.
A girl that I used to date started is dating Tommy Johnson of the Doobie Brothers, right? And so this whole history of intertwining between these rock and roll musicians and seeing him driving around town and Sammy Hagar and even Father Guido Starducci, Don Novello, was a tree client of mine for years. And it took me a while to figure it out. I'm looking at
you
I'm
mean
thinking,
from, was
San
he Anselmo. On, but what was he on?
He's Saturday Night Live.
Saturday Night Live, right.
Father Guido Sarducci.
Right.
And so he'd been my client for like 3 years, 4 years, and I'd meet with him. And I kept thinking, I know him from somewhere. And then we were walking through his garage and he had posters of Father Guido Sarducci on the inside of his garage. And I said, that's where I know you from. So just a real, like seemed like a, just a normal character, but I knew him out of this context from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I figured it out as I saw the poster walking by.
Did you hang out with the Chulis brothers?
I did. So when I was finding myself wanting to get away from this madness and mayhem and theft and crime and drinking and fighting, I did an about face. I was, you know, my years from when I was 16 till I was 19 were pretty rough. A lot of scrapping and just drinking and partying and some cocaine in there. And, you know, young kids trying to find their way through life and with no supervision. So those were rough years. And so I did an about face. My friends were going to prison. My friends were dying. Sarah Nooney, who grew up on Ethel, terrible motorcycle accident, high on drugs, lost, decapitated. Fred O'Neill, a good friend of mine, died of AIDS from blood transfusion in a motorcycle accident that we were involved in together. I witnessed him crash and split his head open and spent 6 months in the hospital. And then the craziness of that lifestyle, I knew that there was a bigger and better person inside of me. So I did an about face and I went completely the other direction. So I stopped going out. I stopped hanging out with these friends. They'd call me and say, no, I'm really busy. I'm working. I really focused my effort and energy into work. So I was working 6 or 7 days a week, passing out flyers when I wasn't working.
Is this you starting your business?
This is me starting my business at 17 and a half.
But did you know about trees at the time or did you just jumped?
So here's an interesting story. So I knew about trees because of a friend of mine, Louis Brunn, and a guy named John Black, and another character that I knew, Joey Adelman. So Joey Adelman was really the spearhead to all these Mill Valley tree guys getting into the tree business. So Joey Adelman, his mother dated a guy named Dwight Barringer, And Dwight Berenger was this rough tree guy. You'd usually find him at the bar. He drank all the time. And he was one of the five tree guys in Marin in the late 70s, early 80s. And so he taught Joey Adelman the skill of climbing trees. And Joey Adelman taught Louie and John Black the same skill. So I saw this young kid, John Black, who was, I guess, my age, maybe a year younger, driving this nice truck and always had all this brush in the back. So I said, hey, I want to come work with you. I want to see how you're doing this and what's going on. So I went to work with him and I learned a little bit, but he and I clashed. There wasn't a real bond between us. So I was going through the Gazette that we used to have, the Marin County Gazette, and I saw some tree gear and some chainsaws for sale. So it was $600 for the gear and the chainsaw. So I asked my grandfather if I could borrow the money. I told him I'd pay him back.
The one that made the liquor?
The one, no, this is the Bertram Hughes, that had the cars, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So
he probably had a buck or two to spare.
He was an entrepreneur. So I knew that he would see a liking to this, right? Mm-hmm. So, and he did it, graciously did it, and I paid him back. And so, but I told the guy, he was a cabbie, the guy that I brought it from. He drove a Mill Valley cab. And so on the side, he was doing tree work to make extra money. And he was tired of doing it because it was hard work. So I said, look, I'm going to buy this gear, but you need to spend 3 hours with me teaching me how to tie these knots and get up the tree, right? So that's all I needed. I'd already been like scurrying up trees with a chainsaw at my mother's house and doing trimming of all her acacias. So I had some hands-on experience. So once he'd spent 3 hours with me, I felt like, oh, I've got this. So I thought. So I started making flyers and I jumped on my mother's bicycle. I had a rack on the front and I'm passing out flyers and still living.
So you're going around Mill Valley, passing out flyers. And of course, people knew you as a local boy.
They did. And I was, I'd get in trouble from the post office. Occasionally they'd call me and say, hey, you can't put things in the post office in someone's mailbox without postage on it. And I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry. And so then I started sticking them on the flag on the side. And then they got in trouble. And then I put them on the doors. And so when I had my mother help me create this flyer. So I was, at the time I was about 18, still kind of getting in trouble and doing this on the side to make money. But by the time I had redirected my energy, I put full focus into my business and started to grow the company, which was fun. And I was a terrible student in school. I just couldn't focus. So when I found a way to pinpoint my energy into one subject, then my mind came alive. Then all of a sudden marketing and adding equipment and the benefit of bringing in new people to help. And so it was fun because I loved it and I found something to focus all this wild energy into. So the next thing I knew, I was 24 years old and had 7 full-time employees and making $100,000 a year doing tree work.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you were mentioning about the Chulis boys. Where did they fit in? Because I ask about the Chulis family, which is one of those families in Mill Valley, because in 1980, I actually went to their house.
Yeah.
My boyfriend at the time took me over to say hi. I ran out of there and I never went back.
I don't blame you. Good idea.
It was wild.
It was very wild.
Yes.
It was very wild. And that was an interesting side of my life, a shift. So I went away from my friends that were causing this madness and mayhem and robbing and thievery and drinking and partying all weekend to something that seemed more balanced and stable,
right?
Which their family unit was incredibly strong. They all really looked out for each other. And I was a handsome young guy, but the womanizing aspect of it was something I wasn't familiar with. So all of a sudden I'm like, wow, interesting. This is a different life. So,
you mean all the beautiful women?
All the beautiful women.
In that lovely huge house.
Oh, that huge mansion with peacocks and underwater sound in the swimming pool.
The name of that house is?
The Burlwood Estate.
The Burlwood Estate over in Cascade Canyon.
Exactly. And the history. And the
bowling alley.
In the bowling alley and the guest house and the cast of characters associated with Vasilius Cholas, the father, right? And so, They remind me, they're like the Kennedys of Marin. That was my experience.
A lot of nice cars in that
A lot park. Of nice cars. Rolls Royces and Porsches. And I'm still friends with all the boys, you know.
And their names?
So there's James is the youngest, James Cholas. Steve Cholas is my age. Alex Cholas is just a year above me. So they had their children fairly close. Then there's Anastasia. And then there's George Cholas, the oldest brother, who's very responsible, very good attorney. They're all lawyers, except for Anastasia, the daughter. So she chose not to go to law school, but they're all attorneys. And so, but it was an interesting time in my life because it was something I was running from one thing and seeing what looked like a family unit, which it was. It was very tight, but the fun and the beach house and the parties and the women, it was like, wow, this is a whole different lifestyle. And I was kind of shocked by all that as well. And then I found myself kind of immersed in it. And like, how do they do this? And how are they meeting these women? And then all of a sudden, next thing you know, I'm enthralled in it myself and analyzing it because it's different than my wiring, right? My wiring's a little different. So, but it was interesting and it was a fun time and it was a time of growth and reflecting back on it. You know, the reality is I wouldn't change anything about my life.
Mm-hmm.
All the ups and downs and ebbs and flows and it creates who we are as people. And I'm kind of a ebb and flow type of person, right? I roll with it. So I enjoyed that phase of my life. There was parts of it that inspired me to build my own, to create my own family because of the family unit and the unity that they had, that they really looked out for each other. And so that was something I had admired. And those boys all slept in, so I couldn't sleep past 5:30, 6 in the morning because I was up to do tree work early mm-hmm. in the morning and mm-hmm. getting ready for the day. So Vasilius and I would have we'd sit down and have coffee together. And I'm 20 years old, 21 years old, 23 years old. And so we'd go out and work in the garden together. We'd rake up leaves and trim stuff, and I'd prune his apple tree, and he'd clean up brush after me. And so I really created a valuable friendship with him and saw a gentle, kind side of that man. He was very cerebral. He spent a lot of time in his head just processing and thinking things through. But he was an amazing trial lawyer as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there were some pretty intense, fun parties there at the house. And it's a good thing he ran.
Oh my gosh, couldn't get out of there fast enough.
Some people stayed and hung out.
Okay, so now you're in your mid-20s. You're making $100,000 a year, which is great.
Yep.
Marin County at that time, there is cash flowing.
There is.
There's
influx of money.
Yes.
And so I capitalized on it. In a sense, I capitalized on my own human nature is what I did. And so I ended up being in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And so not many of my friends were able to do so because they were working for other people. So they'd have to run a little bit farther north to afford the rents.
Mm-hmm.
Where
were you living then?
I was living in Tam Valley. So I moved onto Browning when I was about 20. I rented the downstairs of my mother's house for years till I was about 21. So when she was on Molino Avenue, 486 Molino Avenue, just up from the 2 a.m. club where we lived for years,
mm-hmm.
All through my homestead school years, all through my high school years. And so there was a little bit of a trauma that happened that my mother never wanted to go back to the house, which was a little bit of a frightening story. The Cholas boys had pulled up in some new Cuda, some hot, really cool hot rod that they had just bought. And as we're heading up the hill, I see these characters coming down, looking up at my house, and my sister's there. And I said, hey, you guys have to turn around. I said, there's something weird. These guys are slowing down, looking up at my house, and we're leaving. Oh, you're being paranoid. Don't freak out. So my brother in jail had set up some drug deal with these guys from Oakland. And so next thing you know, it's probably fortunate that I didn't go back because they kicked down the door of the house with pistols and pistol whipped my sister Elizabeth and cased through the house. And it was so traumatic for my mother, she'd never went back to the house. So she rented over on Seminary. She says, "You boys are on your own. I don't want this any of this type of stuff." It was Bobby's stuff, but we were both kind of, you know, trying to find our way through life, and she was trying to create her own life after all these years. So she moved over to Seminary, and we were kind of left to fend for ourselves. So that's when I did live at the Cholas house for a while, trying to find my way and helping them work on their cars and helping Bill work in the garden. And so so then I moved to Browning Drive over in Tam Valley, and I lived there for about a year and a half, parking motorcycles in the kitchen and riding them right into the house and parking them and all my tree trucks and tree equipment there and chainsaws in the garage. And then the landlord didn't like it. It was a little too crazy. So I ended up moving around the corner, 611 Glenwood Avenue. And this is about, this is about 90, let me see, no, wait a minute. What am I saying? This is 85. This is 1985. So I rent this house from Rich Mattos that had a partnership in the 2 a.m. club, and he owned the 7-Eleven franchise. And so 85, I rented that house, and I lived there for many years. So I rented for 10 years, ended up buying the house from him, asking if I could buy it, purchase it from him, and he carries the note. So he carried the note. And then in 99, I tore it down and built about 4,000 square feet of just beautiful craftsman-style home. And then in 06, I sold it and moved to Southern Oregon, so and split my time back and forth. So anyway, so back to those days. Should we pick up?
Well, I think we should go into your business because there's a lot of information that we want to.
Okay, so good.
Somewhere along the way, you started getting better educated in regard to your work. And so you were hyper-focused to do what you needed to do to become a legitimate business owner. And you had found a way that you could capitalize on the best of yourself and I guess leave the worst of it behind.
Exactly. And so here's how that looked was that I wanted to know my trade. So I found myself, you know, immersed in tree work, and I'm like, okay, I need to make the best version of myself that I can. Mm-hmm. So I started reading books by PhD arborist, botanist, horticulturist, plant pathologist, Dr. Richard Harris, Alex Shigo. So I immersed myself in reading and understanding and taking on what I could. And so once I got through that, I thought, well, I need to get my arborist certification because this will validate me as an arborist and as my knowledge. So I've started with the National Arborist Association, which was an easier program. Flew through that certification, and that was very easy. So then I decided to take on my arborist certification, and flew through that really well. So that was nice. And then I thought, well, might as well line up a contractor's license since they're requiring that for arborists doing tree work in the state of California. You had to have a contractor's license as of, I think it was 87 or something. Anybody that was doing any type of contracting had to have a license. So then I jumped on that bandwagon and ended up getting my contractor's license as well.
When is it you first started seeing evidence of sudden oak death?
So with regards to sudden oak death, my first experiences were 91 or 90, 1992. And it was at 321 Evergreen Drive in Kentfield. My client, Don Lewis. Different Don Lewis, luckily, because I know the other Don Lewis too, but a different one.
Okay.
Yeah, very different Don Lewis.
Okay.
So that was, it was interesting because it was something I had never seen, which was very fine micro sawdust, wood boring holes, and then there was a sap exuding, it almost looks like molasses coming out of the tree. And if you touch it and smell it, it smells like a freshly corked bottle of a good quality Merlot or Cabernet. So it's a fermentation process that occurs underneath the bark, basically the tree's natural response mechanisms to try to push a disease out. But the Phytophthora disease is so aggressive that it can fight the tree faster than the tree can fight the disease. So trees have a great capability of fighting off various different insects and other fungi, but some of them are so aggressive that it's just impossible. So I watched, I looked at this tree and I saw this frass and I saw this bleeding, and it was something new to me. So I was so intrigued with what I was doing at work that I wanted to find out what this was, because I wasn't familiar with it. So I called in a Cornell graduate, Ralph Zingaro, who studied under a plant pathologist from Cornell University, Robert Sinclair. And so Ralph and I became good friends. And so I asked Ralph, I said, what's this look like to you? Can you figure out what this is? I've looked through all the books. And he goes, no, I can't. So I'm going to call it an oak decline disease. What did he call it? He called it an oak decline disease. That's exactly what it was. So he wrote a report and said, this oak decline disease, I'm not familiar with what it is. And then I get a call from this Don Lewis at 321 Evergreen Drive. And about 5 months later, he says, Ken, the same thing is happening to the three trees up the side of my house.
And at that point, for those that don't know about sudden oak death, why don't you give an example of actually how it transpires in the tree and how quickly they die?
Okay, good. So here's the misnomer, is that it's not really so sudden. So what's happening is this disease, this battle is being fought in the vascular tissue for up to 8 years. So there's 21 different variations of a tree's own response mechanisms to fight this disease. It's amazing. So some trees have these natural fungistatic qualities that they can push the disease out and fight it off and build cell walls around it. So the interesting thing about trees that's different than the human body is trees compartmentalize disease within them and encapsulate it and wall it off with cell structures and cell forms so that the disease is entrapped within the tree. So where our bodies will heal, a tree compartmentalizes. So if there's decay organisms, it will build up different cell wall structures so that this disease can't penetrate any farther through. So, and something like Phytophthora disease, which there's 61 strains, is aggressive enough to work faster than the tree's response mechanisms. So this battle can sometimes be going on for up to 8 or 10 years, or it can be 6 months. It all depends on the surroundings of the trees, its natural response mechanisms, its genetics. So there's so many different variants that take, how much moisture is it getting? Naturally, or is there a lawn close by? It's a water mold, like the great potato famine of the 1800s. That was a Phytophthora disease. Mm-hmm. So it's an aggressive.
But it acts like a fungus, right?
It is a fungus. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. a fungus. It's a fungal pathogen. Mm-hmm. So and it's aggressive. So rain years, like this last year, we're seeing a whole new flush, a new push of it now in 2019 because of the rains that we got last year. They sporulated like crazy. They'd open up and release these spores.
Like algae, they sporulate with water.
That's exactly it.
But there are specific trees in this area that are vulnerable to it, and that would be the coast live oak.
Yep.
The tan bark oak.
Yep.
The black oak.
Yep.
What's the other one? The shrieve oak?
So the shrieve oak gets it, but so the most susceptible is the tan oak, which is interesting. It's not even really an oak tree. It's a lithocarpus. It's not even in the Quercus family. Completely different species, but highly susceptible to it. So those were the first to just be devastated. So when I saw this moving up Don Lewis's hillside, so I removed these trees and we hauled the material away, not knowing any better, and chipped it.
But just to be clear, when you talk about it can be fighting the battle, but then there's a moment of truth. And then the battle is over and the trees appear to, when you see the first indication, there's a sudden change of color. I've seen trees that you look at them one day and the next day they have a different cast to the tree. And then it's less than a week and they're dead.
I'm glad you mentioned that because the reality is that a tree is interesting in the way that it works because it's like a battery. So through the process of photosynthesis, the sunlight is allowing the tree to make sugars and starches, which it pulling into its main woody limbs and trunk, and even into the buttress roots. It will store this energy. So you could sever all the roots of a tree, and if it didn't blow over due to wind throw, it could live off itself for a long period of time, depending on how many stores, what the food stores are. So the interesting thing is when you see these trees declining, they've been fighting and fighting, and they're giving up their food to try to fight this disease, and they can't recover fast enough through photosynthesis, so they fizzle out like a battery. And that's where you see the chlorophyll just falls out, and the tree goes from this beautiful green, sometimes in 3 days, mm-hmm. to this, you see this grayish sheen, and then it's tan. So it appears to be sudden, but it takes a long time in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
And so the...
So I remember when we were talking, as we were walking through my yard,
as we
were looking at trees, I'm like many people in Mill Valley. I live in Blythe Hill Canyon, and there was a tremendous loss.
Yes.
First, the tambark oaks, and then the coast oaks, and on our property, many.
Yep.
And it just, after the... I guess it was in the 90s that we had quite a die-off. And then came the drought, and all of a sudden, not so many trees dead.
Yeah.
But you described it as one of the very first people to bring this to the attention. Now, I did some research today, there's a lot of people saying that they're the first people.
I have a great resource for you because it's been documented.
Mm-hmm.
So Ray Moritz, who's a local forester and a... he's a consulting arborist, and he's a wealth of knowledge and information. I've known Ray for years, but Ray decided to dig deep into that subject and realize that I am the first, I was the first one to find it, and it'd be worth you. He did a paper and a report on it. He'd probably give you a copy of it.
Mm-hmm. We'll include it with your interview.
Okay, good. Because he did say, I want to know. These people are all claiming that they're the first ones to discover it. So he did the work. And so it's funny, on my way here, I was thinking, now let me see where, because my files only go back to 2002 in my database. Mm-hmm. I wanted to bring in the exact dates that I took Don Lewis's trees out and what date and moving up the hill, and I'd see this progression. So I had none of this information's in my database anymore.
But you didn't give it a name.
I did not. I did not, because it
there
was
an
oak
decline
complex.
There are people that say I'm the first to give it the name. But
Well, in here it says I did, but I don't remember giving it actually in some of this information, mm-hmm. because I did a little bit of legwork myself. But they said, well, Bavero at this time called it sudden oak death. I may have. I don't really remember. In one of these articles, it says that I did, and it was published a long time ago.
Yeah, I've got a here that says a UC – University of California.
Oh, professor. They took a lot of claims too. They were terrible through this process. So Pavel Sfera, he's a PhD, he's a plant pathologist. Mm-hmm. I know these cast of characters well. I've spent a lot of time showing them what I found.
Mm-hmm.
And they love to take the credit because they get funding, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm the little guy on the ground doing all the legwork and they get to take the credit. I went head to head with them when I found it in Redwood in 95.
And you found this in Redwood?
Oh, yeah. I found it at Redwood, right up on Helen's Lane, of all places. When you're coming up, it's not Wildemar. Wildemar.
And then
Wildemar,
you can take a
right.
left
Gomez
on Helen's.
Is the other steep.
Right.
It was a right on Helen's.
Mm-hmm.
And it was down about three or four houses on the left side. This Redwood tree was dying. So I decided that I wasn't calling the feds in because they kept stealing my thunder. So I told them, I asked Ray Moritz to be present to help me take the tissue samples. And so we sent the tissue samples in. They said it is Phytophthora disease, but we don't hold the primer to be able to tell exactly which type of Phytophthora it is. And so you have to go through the UC system, which is Dave Rizzo, Susan Frankel, Matteo Garvalato, Gary Slaughter, these people that I had already been kind of battling with, right? Because they were stealing my thunder.
You got your boxing mitts on when you say
that. I'm like, come on, guys. So they were stealing my thunder. So I remember Pavel Sfera, our local UC farm advisor. He's a plant pathologist. And I called him. The news was there. And I said, look, we want to have a conference. We want to get together. And I said, so Pavel, what are you seeing? What are you calling this? This is Pseudomonas syringae. I said, Pavel, this has none of the characteristics of Pseudomonas syringae. I said, look, I brought the material because he'd already made the statement.
Mm-hmm.
I said, so here, if you look into Robert Sinclair's book, this is what Pseudomonas syringae looks like. Do you see anything that looks similar to this about this disease? Well, no, turn the other page, right? And I turn the other page. I go, yeah, and we're on another disease here now. And so he goes, well, we talk about this later, right? So I go, I'd like to talk about it now. The news is here and these people want to know what's going on. And this to me is a misdiagnosis. So then he came up with, so then I got him on the news with me on Channel 7, right? I said, you know, you need to get Pavel Sfera, the local expert from the UC system, and let's figure this out together, right? Because I wanted another head-to-head with him. So I said, so Pavel, this is my client here. She realizes that her tree is dying, and she's okay if we cut into it and take tissue samples. I said, so what are your thoughts of what's going on here? Because I'm seeing something I've never seen before. And so I want to know, as a plant pathologist, what are you seeing, right? Well, this looks like Armillaria melea. I said, Armillaria melea? I said, where's the mushrooms and the mycelial and the separating of the bark? And well, you take axe right here and you take, he's Bulgarian, right? And he has this deep Bulgarian accent. You take axe right here, you take tissue off sample bark and I show you. So I take this piece off and I go, where is it, Pavel? I go, I don't see the shoestring typical fungus that I'm very familiar with from oak root rot, which is called Armillaria melea. So he's getting frustrated. And I don't blame him because Channel 7's there with a camera. And so I said, look, I said, this is something new to me. I said, it'd be nice if somebody could not call it something that it's not and start doing the research to figure out what it is. I said, I have clients that bought a beautiful house in Ross with the 6-foot diameter oak tree in their entry, and this tree's dead and they're crying. I said, This is horrible. This is devastating. And I said, on a micro level, people have 20 or 30 in their backyard that are dying that are smaller trees. I said, somebody needs to figure out what this is. So back to Don Lewis. So I watched this move up the side of his property. Next thing you know, I see it in a whole bunch of trees above his house. And then the next year, Rick Misuraca, the city of Mill Valley, knows I'm active in this SOD, seeing that I'm in the paper and I'm on the news. And so he said, Ken, I need a price. I've got 266 trees I need taken out of West Blythedale Canyon. So I ended up getting a contract, bid on a contract, and got a contract for 10 oaks, just by the hundreds, dead. So when it came up over the hill from Evergreen Drive right down into West Blythedale Canyon, and then it just spread through Mill Valley like crazy. And you imagine if people are taking firewood or brush from one area to another, or even transporting it. Another really interesting fact was a lot of the wood that was being taken from Joe Garbarino in San Rafael was going to Amador County, Jackson, California. Right over the hill is this huge biomass facility where they grind this stuff up. And my father says, Ken, you got to come up. My Italian friend from the Italian Society has the same looking stuff. And I said, have him take pictures and send it. It's the same thing. So the disease had spread from this facility, right? The dust and the particulate matter spread and infected this hillside in my father's community.
So I did some research and it talks about how virulent they can be, the breeding.
Yes.
Let me read this.
Okay.
Because this gives you an idea. I think it is help explains exactly what you're talking about. Let me just get here. Like the measles of the plant world, it can go airborne. The pathogen quietly attacks a tree by burrowing into the leaves or the bark. Microscopic pods called sporangia float across the air from an infected plant and land on a new leaf surface in a process that sounds like it could have inspired a few science fiction films. The sporangia pod opens up at the tip. It looks like a flying saucer with a little hatch that opens up. The tiny UFO releases around 20 even tinier spores, which have two tails which rotate and propel the spore down to the surface of the leaf. The spore gains energy from the leaf through an attachment process that lets it penetrate the tissue. If the pathogen is near the tree trunk, its spores produce tubes that fit into tiny natural holes in the bark surface.
Yep. It's amazing. It's devastating.
It's the Terminator.
It is. And in this little microscopic little unit, right, that you can't really see, and all this is going on.
And so you're basically in that facility that's grinding up all of this pollinating into an already, like measles, it doesn't necessarily just transmit through contact, but through the aerosol.
It does.
Through air.
It does. And I had another interesting situation. Before all this, when I brought tannoy to my grandmother's house in Paradise. And so I stacked, I used to bring her wood all the time. So I brought her tannoy and some eucalyptus because she burned wood. And so I stacked it at the back of her place. And next thing you know, three of her oak trees on the back of her unit are dead. So I when she was getting the trees removed, I said, look, Grandma, I want to talk to the tree guy that comes out to do it. I said, are you seeing fine little holes with frass and you're seeing something that looks like molasses on the trunk? He goes, yeah. I said, if you grab that stuff and you smell it, does it smell like a Merlot or like a fermentation? He says, it sure does. So little did I know that I was responsible for spreading it to our grandmothers. Now, that's such a cold climate. The disease couldn't live in that climate. So it killed it. It lasted that one season and then it didn't spread to any other part of that area. Because I remember going back up there, looking around like, oh, no, am I responsible for, you know, bringing this disease into this area now? So it was too cold for it to live. So
I'm a hiker. I hike all over. And I've noticed that there can be a lot of tree death on Mount Tam in certain areas in particular. Yeah. But you go out to Mount Burnell. And I don't see a lot of trees. I can see in those rolling hills of Novato, not so much.
Exactly. Isn't Mount Burnell a beautiful area? Those trees
Talk
are
about
magnificent.
Trees. Yes.
Some of those buckeyes that are this big that are hundreds of years old, some of those massive oak trees or bays even.
Anybody that loves trees should hike up Mount Burnell.
It's a beautiful area.
But I am surprised when that, and that would be because of the climate or just the general dryness.
Climate, also bay laurel is a carrier. If you have a bay laurel tree growing within the drip line of your oak tree, you're 10 times more likely to get the infection.
Welcome to Mill Valley.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Because there's a bay laurel for every oak tree.
Yep, 2 to 1. And they're all commingled. So basically the way we're looking at it is the bay is killing the oak, right? Killing off the oak. And so the approach is, as an arborist, is if you really wanted to protect your trees, cut down all the bay laurel. But sure, make sure that you're not leaving trees that are infected already, because then you're saying, well, this is going to be our new buffer. We're going to create room for them. And then they're already infected.
And the buffer goes, and then you've got nothing.
Then you have nothing. So the interesting thing is about the sporulation and the release of the spores. So here's an interesting fact that they sporulate. The temperature range is about 67 to 74 degrees is optimal, right? 72 is like perfect. So this is when these spores in the spring, they open up and they release. Well, that's the same time of year that there's a heavy amount of evapotranspiration. Trees are taking in all these nutrients and moisture and they're expanding in girth. So if you look at oak trees, they have fissures and cracks in them from them understanding wind pressure and growth structures that they need to expand in particular areas to brace themselves, right, for support. So some trees will produce a crack in the bark that's 3 or 4 feet long, and it's a direct avenue for spores to get directly into the tree. So they're so susceptible in the spring with the new tissue, even the pinkish fissures that come that aren't this aggressive fracturing, it's the easiest place for the spores to come washing down the trunk and get into those little pockets and eat their way through into the vascular tissue.
So, have you ever managed to save a tree that was infected?
I have. So, and I give some credit to Pavel Svira. He taught me something. So it all comes full circle, right? So he was, there was a tree, my first tree in San Rafael. I told the client it had 50% of the base of the tree had an enormous canker. Hypoxylon, that black charcoal looking fungus, was already all over the tree. And so they said, we don't care what it costs. We want to save this tree. We want you to do everything possible. So what we did is we made a copper solution that we could buy, which was a fungicide, and we sprayed that all over the the areas that were infected. Then we deep root injected into the soil a phosphorus fertilizer. And so, because Agrifos is basically a phosphoric acid, and so I had a liquid form that I could inject in the soil. And then we drilled into the root flares, and we put phosphoric acid in little bottles that a guy, Ralph Singaro, had created from Bioscapes. And because he was early on the research, he was the one I first called in at Don Lewis's, and then he talked to a company to start making a phosphite compound that we could inject directly into the trees. And so I told him, I said, look, you're probably throwing your money away, but well, let's do what we can and completely reverse the symptoms of the disease. Not a trace of it to this day.
Do you do that kind of treatment regularly now?
So now it's a refined process. So now what we're doing is we have a backpack and it has an air tank and it has a one-way plug that goes in the tree. So it will only allow material in, but won't allow anything to come back out. So one of the problems was that you were drilling a hole in a tree and putting a bottle on. The great thing was that Ralph Singaro had found it's called Phyton 27. I haven't seen it for years, but it was a grafting compound with a fungicide paste in it. So as soon as you pulled the bottle off, you had to put this material on.
And most like spackle.
Like spackle. And it was a grafting compound, so it would accelerate growth, mm-hmm. so it would close up, and it had a fungicide so that nothing could come in or go back out. So it was an amazing product. I don't know whatever happened to it. But so tree guys were doing injections and then they're leaving a direct wound and pulling these bottles off. And then there's a hole in the tree and it's a perfect avenue for everything to all the spores to wash down and get right in. So now ArborJet makes this gun that you drill this hole and you tap this cap in there and you push this little needle in and you push a button and it injects and pushes this product in and nothing's coming back out. It's all going into the vascular tissue. And for up to 6 months, it's traveling all the way around through the tree, killing off any of the Phytophthora, if the tree's strong enough. And so on top of that, so here's a great thing that I learned from Pavel. So I went out to a client's house in Fairfax, and I saw that this enormous section of her tree had been chiseled open, all the bark taken off, and probably half an inch of the bark down to all this pinkish tissue, the inner bark layers. And I said, what happened here? I said, this is horrible. Well, Pavel Svira came out and he opened up. He said, this is the new treatment. And I said, this is ridiculous. What is he doing? I can't believe this. I said, I've never heard of this. And so I was not a believer in it. The next year she called me back. She goes, Ken, you've got to come see my tree. All new callus development, all new bark tissue. Not a trace of sudden oak death. I've been taking care of that tree for the last 10 years. There's not a sign of sudden oak death on it. So the new process is catch it early, take a chisel, take off the first quarter inch of the bark. You can see the margins of the disease. There's discoloration. There's a dark brown edge of the disease. So as long as you keep tracing and tracing and you find those parameters and you make a full circle, then you've got the entire disease encapsulated in one area and you hit it with Reliant, which used to be Agrifos. They changed the name. And I'll tell you, I've never seen anything work like it. It's amazing.
Wow. Good to know.
Yeah. So will the forest department do it on a forest? No, it's too expensive.
Uh-huh.
But for homeowners, it's a great way to save their trees.
Before we walk away from this subject, yes. which is such an important one yes. here, what haven't we talked about that we should include about the sudden oak death and your experiences?
Let's see. I feel like we covered it, but what can you think? Can you think of anything?
One thing.
That we should touch on?
One thing I do wonder about, because
yes.
I see this around town,
yes.
where the trees are dead, but they're not taken down.
Yeah.
How much more vulnerable are they to falling? Not everybody can afford.
Yeah.
It's very expensive to take trees down.
Yep, it is.
So what are the risks of leaving a tree that's dead up?
Extreme liability. So here's initially... The tree has some viability because it still has moisture in its stems, right, and its trunk. So initially the tree loses its leaves and it's still pliable and rubbery, so to speak. what happens is you get secondary pathogens coming in. You have insects coming in and breaking down the cellulose of the wood and the structure. So the first three or four months, the tree is safer than it was with leaves on it. The next 6 months after that, it dries out very quickly, becomes extremely brittle, and is subject to complete root failure or branch failure. And they fall apart and break apart, as you've probably seen when you're hiking. Just big sections of trees crashing down on the ground.
I've seen an entire tree just go over in a minute.
Yep.
Just like that. And not all of them look even that sick.
Yep.
Some of them are, but it can happen just in a flash.
It can.
An entire section of the tree or the whole tree.
Exactly. Exactly. And sometimes when they're infected, you know, trees like humans are all, we're all so different, but imbalances, right? Imbalances are a huge problem with trees. Like just on a regular evaluation, the horizontal stuff is the most likely to fail. It's not the upright. So you imagine if you pick up a 25-pound weight and you hold it close to your ear, it's not so heavy, and you hold it out to your side, it exponentially increases the weight on not your entire body and your arm and your shoulder. So the leverage effect of trees is a big problem. So as long as you can keep the end weight tucked in and eliminate or reduce, I should say, that end weight, any tree will be safer. So a lot of the times what you're seeing is even trees that become infected and they're still green, the trees will fail because they're weakened by the disease and there's already such an imbalance.
Mm-hmm.
But a dead standing tree from sudden oak death, after the first year of it dying, then it starts to fall apart and anything can, huge sections can fall off, the whole tree can uproot. There's a ton of other fungi and insects that come in to finish it off.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, a declining tree will produce ethylene, which is part of that fermentation. And the ethylene
is— That's a hormone.
It is. Mm-hmm. And the like a pheromone, mm-hmm. it's an attractant to wood-boring insects that here we have a declining tree.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sending out a signal. And so the wood-boring insects, so that's why you're seeing this frass associated with sudden oak death, is an ambrosia beetle comes in. And it starts to eat through all the wood and lay its own fungi, vectors in its own food source as it comes in and lays eggs in there. And then western bark beetle and then termites and a whole host of things move in. So, and that's the degradation of the, you know, the forest of eating everything up and a whole different life cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So they are more prone to failure after about a year, 8 months to a year after they die. Then the wood loses that moisture in it and loses its cellulose and starts to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's a huge liability for a homeowner or a city or the county.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have dead trees looming over trails and streets and roads. And yeah, so.
And we have increased fire.
Increased fire, yep.
Because we've got all that fuel.
Yep.
Nothing a fire likes more than oxygen and some fuel.
I know. You're not kidding.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was very interesting.
Good.
And congratulations on being the first person to discover sudden oak death.
Yeah, it was an interesting ride.
Yes. Okay. So let's talk about some of the other ways in which you have collaborated or, you know, partnered with the county or the park systems. I know that you mentioned to me in an earlier conversation about the work you did at Muir Beach.
Exactly. So I love restoration and giving back has always been a fun part of what I do. Like I like to, if I see a situation that seems out of balance, I like to give my time or the company's time to fix it. In this case, it's a little different. I've worked with the federal government, whether it's National Park Service, GGNRA, Presidio Land Trust, and Department of Interior for roughly 30 years. So I got to work on that beautiful project that they did out at Muir Beach, where they restored that entire valley. Because at some point, I'm not sure if it was a Banducci family that had that 100-year lease on a piece out there or who it was, but the contour of that valley was completely changed. Somebody went in there with a tractor and just started recontouring the land and the flow of the creek then to suit their needs. So the people in charge ended up doing 2,600 core drillings to find out exactly where the original contours were and mapped it out.
That was people in charge, you mean GGNRA?
GGNRA. And it was, I was trying to remember the name. I've worked with her.
Mia?
For years. I know Mia. Also, Mia was part of that team. But the big, the heavy hitter, I can see her face, and it will come to me because I've worked with her for years. That's terrible.
It'll come to you.
It will come to me. I better not. So that was a an interesting project because they wanted I had a project going along the shoreline by the Golden Gate Bridge, and they wanted huge, enormous, okay.
Keep going.
40-foot trunks because they wanted to pin them into the creek for salmon habitat. So they had me harvesting trees on a project in San Francisco, and then they selected six trees out at the out on one of their properties, the Banducci Ranch in Muir Beach, to harvest 40-foot stems of eucalyptus, retaining the root ball so that they could use this for fish habitat. So here I had a special truck designed and built to haul these huge pieces of trunk and root ball. So the process was incredible. So we brought in an excavator, and I had a root hook made that pinpointed the load on a one-inch surface on this huge piece of steel, because eucalyptus have enormous, powerful roots. So we took the 60,000-pound machine, and we'd reach in the ground, and we'd start pulling like this, and then you'd feel resistance, boom, and you'd pop this.
How big
mess.
Is the hook?
The hook is 4 feet tall and about a foot wide, but it has a radius edge of 1 inch. So you're taking all that pressure and loading it on this kind of fine tip, on this tip, so to speak, so that you're condensing all that inertia and energy. Boom, and it would fracture these roots, and you'd see the whole thing move. And then once we went all the way around the tree, then we'd take the beak, the hook, reach up as far as we could, and we'd push it over. And then it was pickaxes and guys for hours taking pickaxes, cleaning all the dirt. They did not want dirt coming from other areas to come to this site. So then it was pressure washing. And so they had to be certified by them that they were clean enough to then move across the Golden Gate Bridge on this truck I had built and brought out to Muir Beach. And so when I went out to the site, I looked and I got upset. I go, what did you do with all the trunk? Why'd you just put the root ball in? They go, no, we had this enormous machine take that 40 foot of enormous trunk and pin it into the soil. Because all you saw sticking out of the ground was the root ball. And it was amazing that some of the trunks at the end, I'll call it the fine end, were 3 feet in diameter, that they just pushed with some massive piece of equipment. So on a 200-year storm, they're not going to wash away. They're pinned way down into the soil. So the numbers for
it's like one of those titanium tooth implants.
You're not kidding. So what an amazing what they did out there. They grew native grasses in their greenhouses from seed stock that they'd taken 6 years before. They shook all the seeds out of native bushes and shrubs within a 2 mile radius so that they had the same genus that what was there 200, 300, 400 years ago. It's amazing to be part of projects like that. I love it. I go back and I go, wow, look at what was here and what's here now. So the fish restoration project turned out really well. The red-legged frog ponds have outstanding numbers. They know better what those numbers are, but I remember them sharing the numbers with me, and they were staggering. Another one was an interesting one over Langdon Court. Well, this isn't Mill Valley, but a project we worked with, it was called Valley of the Serpents. And it was a really heavy, like real steep terrain. And so we cleared hundreds of trees off because they used to back up the dump trucks in the 50s and 60s, and they'd take all the lead-based paints and stuff that they'd take off the buildings and siding, and they'd dump them over the side towards the ocean. So they had to recontour a lot of this earth to get it back. There was lead on the beaches, and so they had to clean all this material up.
Where is this?
So this was all along the shoreline on Lincoln. So if you hit the Golden Gate Bridge, you make the first right-hand turn, and you're on that steep shoreline, they recontoured a whole bunch of that. They would take areas that had terrible soil that was contaminated, back it up over the edge and just dump them. This is in the 50s and 60s, right? Maybe even 40s. I don't know the timelines they do, but so I remember on one of the sites we had to take out all the Monterey pine that was down there, some eucalyptus and some Monterey cypress. They did the recontour work. They were getting ready to replant. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere comes all this habitat that they didn't even know the seed stock was in the ground. Things that they weren't familiar with ever grew in that area. And now I walk through it and this stuff is this tall.
And you're holding your hands up to be about five and a half feet.
About 5.5 feet tall. It's incredible. It's called Valley of the Serpents. There's the area. And to see what naturally came back in, it was amazing. So that was a fun one because they were planning on replanting and then they started seeing all this stuff coming up.
Not necessary.
No. So it was that was a fun project to be part of.
How does it feel when you go to a place like on Lincoln, on those cliffs, or into Muir Beach to know that you played a part of?
I feel blessed. I feel like, wow, this is my backyard and I get to give. I get to give back. I get to do my part, right? Mm-hmm. So, and sometimes I forget about all of it that I do, and I'll sit there and I'll go, wow, remember 25 years ago when we worked on this restoration site or we cleared this area? And there's so many that I was talking to one of my employees yesterday. I was helping them on a project, and we started to recall a whole bunch of projects we worked on. And it's incredible. It's a great feeling.
What is an arborist's nightmare? You work in an area where there's all kinds of people that have a lot of ideas of how they want things to be. And maybe they're not used to negotiating with Mother Nature.
Or neighbors.
What's an arborist's nightmare?
Man, Tiburon. There's a reason there's three tree attorneys in Marin and that's all they do. I met with a client last week and it's a legal dispute and it just tasted bad from the minute I got out of the car. And right away I could just feel, I'm like, oh, this is another legal situation. No, please. So our energy didn't jive real well. I think we were both aware of that, but she had a mission and she was butting heads with her neighbor and they both had attorneys. And to me, I feel like there's always a way to work something out, hopefully. But it's such a litigious community that we're in, and it's so different than how it used to be, that is very frustrating to me, and it gets very frustrating to my guys. Because then attorneys are coming over, and they're telling the men to take 3 more inches off, but we've taken it to the height that was already agreed upon by the plastic pole that was made for 23 feet at this piece where this stake is. And so then it halts the whole crew and attorneys are driving over and it just gets so frustrating. And to see these people spend $150,000 a piece on legal fees when it's $3,000 worth of trimming, they could have split it, or one could have said, you know what, I benefit from the view, so I'll pay for it. So that to me gets really frustrating.
I remember in a situation on my own street where a neighbor cut another neighbor's tree to improve the view.
Yes.
And the people whose tree had been cut weren't too happy about it.
Yeah.
And you spoke to the person who had the tree cut.
Yeah.
And you advised, listen, lady, you did this so you could improve your view.
Yep.
You essentially sawed the top off the trees.
Yep.
Very soon you're going to have basically a hedge.
Exactly.
And if you'd like to keep your view, I recommend that you find a way to work something out. Yeah. You did cut their trees.
Yeah. Yeah. And there comes lawsuits. I mean, there's lawsuits that occur from this. So, you know, somebody thinks that it's okay to go saw the top of somebody's tree off. There's ratios that we have to follow by the International Society of Arboriculture, and one of which says never cut more than 20% of the green foliage off a tree at any given time or it can be harmful to it because of that photosynthesis process that we talked about in food stores. Now, that number used to be 30% and has recently changed to 20, which I agree with. But there's instances where people have bay laurel trees that are obliterating their view, and I inform them, look, this is a bay laurel. It's a pyrophytic tree. It's not a high-valued tree. So if it was me and it would improve my quality of life, I would do the reduction. The tree's going to sprout back. I've even seen in situations where we've had to do it with oak trees, where we're cutting them to stubs on a legal request, and they do come back. So the reality is it changes the overall structure, and it changes the intrinsic beauty of a natural plant structure or tree. But in some cases, I see where it's warranted and where it's needed. But as long as you're informing the person that owns the tree, here's what can happen. And so then it's their educated decision to make the best decision that's right for them.
How about now we've got some changes going on in our community because of the increased fire risk? Well, with climate change and also the fuel load, which is steadily built up.
Yeah.
And people are being advised to remove the lower branches.
Yep.
And to remove trees, flammable trees, such as the Italian cypress,
the juniper,
the bamboo,
and
the acacia.
Yeah. I think that you look at each one situationally. I think that's such a broad brushstroke that I feel like it's a case-by-case situation. This whole nothing within 3 feet of the house to me doesn't seem to be fair or right. Even though it's a highly combustible area, and if you have that already, it's great. But if you have beautiful specimen Japanese maples or beautiful specimen black pines or oak trees that have been in there and you cut all this down and your value of your house is $300,000 less, I think that there should be some type of release form that says, look, if you want to make the house more susceptible to fire and you want to keep this stuff, then you can sign off here and we'll leave you alone. But then,
I've interviewed firemen who have explained, and you can listen to these interviews, about the science of fire control is changing, that fires themselves are changing with changing climate, and the ability to fight fire as they had in the past has changed. So now it's a lot more threatening.
I get it.
So that's I have a feeling will be an ongoing discussion.
Too. Did you make it to the meeting that they had a month ago, Thursdays?
Oh, no,
everybody,
not.
The community came out. And I mean, it was it was a big battle, it sounded
like.
It's
an inflammatory subject.
Very much
no
so.
No pun intended.
So I myself in Oregon, I planted a lot of stuff close to my house, right? Barberry and not such flammable stuff, but it is stuff close to my house. And I love the way it looks. Granted, I have a big green lawn also all the way around my house, so I have a nice buffer, and I have a concrete roof. So I feel like I'm pretty well protected, but you look at some of these videos of this fire situations where the rosemary is growing right up near the side of the house, and there's a whole bunch of duff from it that's carrying oils, and it's very dry. And one little ember... They're realizing that it's not so much that shake roof that you had, that the shake was this thick. It's the little fine stuff around the edges that starts the other stuff burning right up the side. And then once it hits the eaves and it starts to burn inside, then the vents on the bottom start to become an avenue. They have to suck oxygen in to feed the fire. And then embers are pulling in through the vents. I mean, it's just the fire science that they've learned from these past couple years of fires is amazing.
Right.
Yeah, what a huge benefit.
Tell me about the arborist dream.
It's different for every one of them. So for me, here's a phrase I learned years ago. And I'm a big Tonka toy boy kid, right? So I love sitting on an excavator working on a restoration site. But it's a clearing site. You're taking out 6 foot diameter eucalyptus trees and you have a 60,000 pound machine and you have logging trucks and 1200 horsepower wood chippers that chip material this big for 20 feet in length. And so that to me is exhilarating. So you have oak men and you have euke men, right? And I'm more a euke man, where Louis that worked with me for 25 years, he's definitely an oak man. So he'd love to be sculpting the interior of an oak, where I'm a little big and it's hard for me to get around in a little oak tree. So that varies. But I did have a huge conflict. Avatar is one of my favorite films. And when I watched Avatar, I was in the middle of a restoration site. We were restoring a site. So we were clearing all the Monterey pine and eucalyptus in the Presidio. And when I saw that big tractor coming down to take out Mother Tree, I sobbed because I was in such conflict with myself. Because really, I have to be careful, I get emotional about
it. It's okay.
I can relate with both sides, but more so with that whole Mother Tree side about the power, the beauty of plant life and life itself, and that life to me, I like to everybody to bring everybody up, right? To build each other up so that we're all at a higher level. And so that was such a struggle for me.
I remember talking to your daughter Mackenzie,
yeah,
who works in your office.
Yeah.
And she told me that you had read The Hidden Life of Trees.
Yes.
And it had thrust you into a moral dilemma.
It did. Because the side of me is that the guy that wants to save the forest and save the trees, but yet the playful boy in me wants to go wreck things and break things up, right? So it's an eternal struggle, but I'm finding that the Avatar side of me is winning more of these battles. So I'm less inclined to want to do larger projects, even though it's been such a big part of what we've done for 30 of the 40 years of business.
Does it mean that it changes the way that you get work? I mean, do you go to people's houses and say, I don't want to cut that tree down?
I do. So, I'm glad you asked that, because there's certain trees, there's redwoods and oak trees, I just won't do it. I look at the tree and I think, what a beautiful specimen. And they want to add on to their house. And I'm like, you bought these trees as part of this property. And these trees have been here longer than this house ever has been. So, you know what? If you want to add on, we should have bought something that was bigger, had more of what you wanted. So that's a struggle for me. I like to be very upfront. So I had a client yesterday. It was last Thursday before I left. And she wanted to cut down her oak tree. And I said, well, why do you want to take this beautiful tree down? Well, it drops all these leaves. And I said, drops all these leaves? I said, look at all the sun. It's blocking you from all the sun. And look at the shade you get from it. Look at the beauty of this tree. Why would you ever? Well, one of the other tree guys said it had a root fungus. I said, will you show me where he saw the root fungus? He says, well, all this stuff growing on the ground out here. I go, these are lichens. These are native lichens. I said, this guy's crazy. And it's a guy that I taught the tree business to. And I said, you tell him. I told him that he's completely wrong. And here's what I recommend you do. I want you to call this individual consultant. You've got two conflicting people that are arborists that are telling you two different things. Call in this neutral party and see what they say. But it was just terrible. I run into it all the time. People, there was one earlier today. As a matter of fact, it was 6 redwood trees in Tiburon. When I was called to look at a project in the backyard for some pruning they wanted to do. And I saw that they were cutting this pathway to the house and they were cutting redwood roots like this.
And you're holding your hands up and you're giving me a circle and it's about
4 inches in diameter.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And just 5 feet from the base of these beautiful heritage trees. And so I sent him a letter because I have an obligation. I'm out there. I said, look, when I was out, I noticed that you're cutting the roots of these trees. You're going to cause these trees to go into decline. This is a life support system and their feeding mechanism for the trees. So I get a call today and it's the same place. And here we are a year and a half later. The house is all reconstructed, looks beautiful. They put their $3 million into it and their trees are dying. I said, do you remember the letter that I sent you? Well, yeah, but we didn't know how severe it was. I said, I explained that you're killing your trees. I said, so I don't know if I could have been more clear, but so now, well, the other arborist said we have to cut them all down. I said, if you want to cut them all down, that's up to you, but you do not have to. I said, we need to bring in some fertilizer, some very slow release fertilizer, some sea kelp that we'll inject into the soil to help the roots recover. You need to start watering. This was a lawn that was here before. I said, now that your trees are getting zero water when they used to get watered once a day, every day. I said, so you need to start putting a soaker hose today here, over here. I marked six. I had flags in my car. I put six different flags down. I said, the hose needs to run at a fairly high trickle in each one of these spots for 6 hours to get a nice deep saturation into the root zone. So it was horrible, right? Just a little bit of precaution could have saved these beautiful 4 foot diameter redwood trees. The little ones were 3 feet. The big ones were 4.5 feet in diameter. And just the whole tops were dead. Just terrible.
Do you ever feel that you're guided by the trees that you're around?
No question. No question. I feel I'm a empathetic person. It's tough because I feel other people's pain a lot of times. And so I go into a situation and I'll look and I don't understand their concept or what they're trying to do. And I fight and I fight. And I say, look, I wouldn't do it. And if this is what you want to do, I'm not the person to do it for you. I just don't feel this is right to do. So, and it almost cost me one of my big government contracts. It was at Tennessee Valley Beach. And there was this big, beautiful eucalyptus tree, just the incredible specimen, about 7 or 8 feet in diameter. And these big 3 foot diameter limbs. And Sharon Farrell, that was who I was trying to think of on the project that she was running, that big project out there at the creek restoration at Redwood Creek and Muir Beach. And Sharon was there. And Sharon and I had worked together for years. I go, Sharon, I go, do you realize what this tree is? She goes, it's a non-native species. I go, yeah, but Indians were probably cracking acorns underneath this tree and opening shellfish. I go, this is one of the original, this is the grandfather tree of the Tam Valley.
But weren't those trees brought in, eucalyptus, usually by the military?
They were, but I don't know. This was this beautiful, one of the most stunning eucalyptus trees I'd ever seen. And I said, I get all these little offshoots and all these, but what's the chance? What if I write an arborist report and we just say that this is a specimen for this type of tree? And if you guys monitor and make sure it doesn't, she goes, Ken, it's a non-native tree. We're clearing out all these non-natives. It's part of our long-term plan. I'm like, Sharon, you got to take a stand for this. Look at this. She goes, Ken, do you want to be part of the project or not? And I'm like, oh, that one hurts. So I said, all right, Sharon, I don't agree with it. And then someone else got the job. I didn't get that project because I didn't really want it. And I bid it kind of high. Didn't feel right to me. And the contractor ended up blowing, his machine blew a big hose. And he was making derogatory comments towards some of the staff. And the staff reported him to the EPA. It got really ugly. So that tree was trying to take a fight for itself and stand for itself. So, but I will frequently take a stand for trees.
How about a good tall tree tale? Ever see anything unusual, something special, something really unusual?
Yeah. So let me see. The first thing that comes to my mind is when I was in Tiburon, when I was climbing roughly 30 years ago, and I was Hacienda Drive in Tiburon, and I'm in the stand of Monterey Cypress, and I hear this hissing in my ear. And I look over, and there's a bat on my shoulder hissing in my eyeball, right? I look over, and it's right here. And I freaked out. I hit myself so hard on my shoulder that my spikes came out of the tree. I'm hanging from my core rope. I smashed the poor bat on my shoulder. It's mangled on the ground. I freaked out. I had to come out of the tree. It was in my mind, it was a vampire, right? I was just like I was in Dracula. So it was so crazy to me. And then I remember another really scary situation that happened where my friend and I, Craig Peterson, we were doing these trees across the street from my mother's house, and they were big eucalyptus trees, and he wanted them out of there. And so we were taking them out, and we decided to race each other to the top of the tree. So we're running up the tree with our core ropes, and we're running up. And he says, hey, and I go like this, and I'm 2 inches from going over the top of the tree and falling to death, unfortunately, onto a pile of logs.
Oh, no.
And my knees collapsed, and I sat there just like dazed and confused. I couldn't climb for 5 days. I was so freaked out, and it haunted to me. To this day, I still have nightmares about it. If I threw my rope up a little bit harder, I would have been down on the wood pile 90 feet below me. It was scary. That was the biggest fear. And I was like, don't always stay humble, right? You know, always be cognitive, always be alert of your surroundings. Because I was that close to going over the top when I went like this. And I just, my knees just buckled. So it was scary. That was a really intense moment. Let's see, there's the tree business is so interesting because you've got tree guys and trucks and equipment. And so I remember one time this person wanted the wood chips from one of our projects. So my guy backs our huge dump truck all the way up the driveway, and he starts to dump the truck, not realizing that he's on unlevel ground. And as the bed's coming up, the truck's starting to fall down the hill, and it tumbles down her front yard and into the street in Tam Valley. That was not fun. It was not fun. So, you know, unfortunately, things happen in the tree business. They always have. They always will. Guys forget to set a brake on something, and it's rolling off with a chipper on it. And so they happen to everybody. So you could say, oh, no, it's not going to happen to me, or it doesn't. It happens to everybody. So.
Well, you are a robust individual.
Yes.
And how long do you think you're going to be able to keep it up?
That's a good question, because I'm 58 and I still feel like I got this till I'm 75. So we'll see what happens, right? Time will tell. Genetics have been good to me so far, and I take good care of myself. So we'll see. Unfortunately, my grandfather, my mother's father passed away at 58, the age I am now. So I decided to get my cholesterol level checked. It was high. My blood pressure's been high. So I've made some life adjustments. And so far, my blood work, they look like I'm doing a much better job. So
you can save yourself from a heart attack and fall off a tree instead.
Exactly. And you know, I've had 32 motorcycles over the years and ridden like a maniac, and I'm still here. So I feel like every day is a blessing. All the tree climbing I did and all the heavy equipment stuff and falling huge, massive trees at Dominican and just it's been an interesting life, and I've enjoyed it the whole way through.
Is there anybody that you'd like to mention, if you haven't mentioned a name, somebody that's been an inspiration, family members, before we close?
You know, the one person I could think of is my grandfather. Even though I never got to know him really well, I feel like there's a big part of him that lives in me. And so I feel like I got a good business sense from him. My father's been, he's a fairly conservative person, but been a great voice of reason to me along the way. So, and then I have friends like my friend Rick Misuraca, that was the city arborist here for years, that's just a very emotionally balanced person. Michael Hinkes at Dominican University that I worked with for 30 years. Just people that I've looked up to over my life and helped me create more balance. Even like Vasilius Cholas, those garden talks with him and seeing a different way of life. So I feel like we're here to learn, and every day is an opportunity to learn something new. And so I try to keep everything open so that I can take in what I can. So, and I love to share my knowledge for those people that will take it. So I love to tell stories, and I love to tell stories about life, and I love restoring old cars and hot rods and stuff. That's a passion of mine. So I try to be an inspiration to others as well in my actions and in my God-given, genetically given optimistic attitude. And for some reason, I've been blessed to have a lot of energy. So hopefully my battery doesn't run out early.
No. SOD for you.
Exactly. No SOD. If so, a couple treatments and we'll turn it around. We'll chisel it out and we'll keep going.
One word of advice to young arborists.
Be safe. Hone your craft and your skill set. Always learn as much as you can so that you can, and keep your eyes open so that you can better yourself and your trade.
Okay.
All right.
I think we got it.
Great.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
For coming here today on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Library. I believe that concludes your interview.
Great. Good to see you.
Good to see you too.